Welcome to In the Author's Studio. And today we have with us Greg Sattell. We'll be discussing the book, Cascades. I'm Andrea Cates, and I'm with Future Proofing Next. And Future Proofing Next, we say we're innovation you can take to the bank. And we work with corporations and teams and scale-ups to figure out ways to see ahead into the future and actually do something about it to drive business growth. The first thing we want to do with Greg Sattell, first of all, welcome, Greg. We're super excited to have you here in the author's studio.
Thanks so much for having me, Andrea.
And people are probably wondering what it's like to go to a book club where you haven't read the book, or to go to a conversation in a meeting. We know Amazon is famous for making sure that everyone reads the six-page document before the meeting starts. So I've read your book many times and reviewed it, love the book, feel like it's really relevant to the important priorities for leaders today in terms of going from an older mindset of leadership to a newer mindset of leadership. And what we believe at Future Proofing is that there's a need to lead in a new way, especially in the current economic situation and in the current global situation. So we would love for you to give us, in a nutshell, what is it about?
I was wondering what the significance of that. I was sitting here so puzzled.
In a nutshell.
I was thinking, what's the point? Because I wasn't sure if they were nuts or they were pits.
Yeah.
I wasn't sure who it referred to, whether it was you or whether it was me. But
yeah. What we like to do in the beginning is have you give us, kind of in a nutshell, like the way we talk about elevator pitches in startup land, in the world of Cascades, and especially as it pertains to business leaders, what are the foundational principles before we get into some of the details? What is Cascades in a nutshell?
Cascades is about transformation. And in my first book, Mapping Innovation, I talked about innovation is a three-part process of discovery, engineering, and transformation. And I think we vastly underestimate what it takes to make a transformation. We focus on the idea, whether it's a good idea, or whether it's whether the thing works or doesn't work. And if it works and it's a good idea, we kind of feel like our job is done. But in actuality, it takes, on average, about 30 years to go from an initial discovery to a real impact on the marketplace. That gives us an indication of how difficult a transformation is. And since then, in further research, I found that it's often very, very difficult to drive a transformation, even for things that we know that work. Skills-based transformations about things like agility, agile development, like user-centered design, stuff that we've known really works for 10 or 20 years. And even that is hard to get adopted widely throughout an organization. So it's a very, very difficult process getting change to take hold. And that's what I tried to provide a roadmap for in Cascades.
Well, one of the things that we'll talk about now is we'll get a little bit more into the discussion, because the reason that we're so interested in this is that the future proofing community tends to be people who are pragmatic. We love examples. We love news you can use, things that have really happened. And we'll talk about some corporate examples, especially later on in our conversation. And the theory is really important as well. But the first thing that I think is really important to talk about is how you really got interested in change and how change has changed. So could you talk a little bit about the fact that change has changed?
This is actually a statistic I came across recently, but it blew my mind. So in 1975, 83% of a typical corporation's assets were tangible assets. So things like physical plant, a factory, equipment, maybe money in a bank account, but things that we could touch. By 2015, that had flipped, and 84% of a typical corporation's assets are intangible. Now, remember you have to remember that the whole practice of change management took place in the early 80s. So what what was change back then was usually some kind of physical change, a strategic change. In fact, the first case study was Burroughs versus NCR and how they adapted to electronic computing. So you're talking about investments that were made at a very, very senior level, if not the CEO level. And change management was really about making people okay with those changes. Where today, we're 84% or probably even higher now, are intangible assets. When we talk about change, we're talking about changes in the people themselves, what they believe, how they think, how they act. And that's a completely different thing. So when we talk about change management, the traditional change management, we're talking about the 1983 version of change management for the most part. It's as if we have this entire practice or almost industry that's focused on teaching people to make really to make really good mixtapes with cassettes or to DJ with cassettes. Well, that would be great if anybody had an interest or if that was at all useful. But nobody uses cassette tapes anymore, and probably a large portion of your audience has no idea what a cassette tape is. And so it's really important that we, when we think about change, we think about as it exists today. And that is getting people to change how they think and how they behave. And that's a much different thing because people don't like to change.
Well, one of the things I want to talk about is, well, first of all, I'm curious if this is universal, because I know we were just having a conversation a little bit ago about China and the differences in some geographies in terms of whether it's a physical asset-based or a talent-based society right now, what the economic drivers are, whether they're a market or manufacturing product production, where innovation comes from in different regions. And I know that you didn't just come up with your theory from the United States. Was curious, first of all, where this idea came from, and also whether you think these ideas are universal or mostly Western, you know, America, North America. So talk a little bit first about where you came up with the idea, you know, and then I'd love to talk about geographies, whether these are things that are applicable around the world right now.
So this is this picture really brings back a lot of memories. It's from the Orange Revolution in Kiev, Ukraine, which took place in 2004 and 2005. And I was living in Kiev then, and I was not only living there, I was leading a major news organization. So this is something I was very much involved with. And a couple of things really made an impression on me. First of all, there was this incredible feeling of confusion where nobody seemed to know, to really have a grip on exactly what was going on or what would happen next. Certainly not the journalists that I would speak to every day in the newsroom, not the other business leaders, nor the political leaders that I would run into from time to time, really understood. Nobody who had any conventional form of power seemed to have any real ability to shape events. And at the same time, there was just this mysterious force that nobody could describe, but nobody could deny, that seemed to be moving events along. And you would see thousands upon thousands of people who would ordinarily be doing very, very different things, all of a sudden stop what they were doing and start doing the same thing in almost perfect unison. And I thought to myself, gee, I'd really like to know how to do that. And I wish I could get, you know, I had thousands upon thousands of potential customers, all, you know, buying different things. Wouldn't it be great if I could get them to all unify on the one thing I was trying to sell them? And I had hundreds of employees, all bright people, ambitious with their own ideas. I wanted them to embrace the few initiatives that I thought needed to be priorities. Similar things with investors and advertisers, but I had no idea how to do that. And And then it was just a couple of years later, I was in Silicon Valley. Everybody's talking about social networks. I thought it was something I should learn about. I started studying network science and found almost a perfect mathematical representation for everything that happened during the Orange Revolution. And that's how I got hooked on studying movements. And then, and this goes very much to your point about societies, then I met my friend Serja, who overthrows countries for a living. He started in Serbia.
Wait, is that on his business card? Like I overthrow countries?
Not exactly. I've never actually seen his business card, actually. He spends a lot of time in out-of-the-way locations, that's for sure.
Yeah.
But he has created this repeatable model for overthrowing for transforming societies. He helped lead the movement that overthrew Milosevic in Serbia. Then he trained the guys in Georgia with the Rose Revolution, then Ukraine, the Orange Revolution. And then he created this organization called the Center for Applied Nonviolent Action and Strategies. And since then, they've been active in almost 50 countries throughout the world, on every continent you can think of, from Egypt to Zimbabwe to Burma and on and on and on. And he found this, he has developed this repeatable model that he actually found from another guy named Gene Sharp. So a lot of this stuff has been around for decades. And I wanted to find out, the question I was interested in was, can this be applied into an organizational or industrial setting? And that was really the exciting thing about researching Cascades, is going out and finding people who'd run or been involved with major corporate or organizational or societal transformations and seeing if those same principles applied. And in fact, what I found is they applied to an incredible extent, so much so that I would sometimes ask people questions and they would say, really, is that like a thing? Because that happened to us, but I didn't know that was, is that usual? And you'd hear the same echoes of the same experiences in vastly different contexts.
Well, I'm going to break it down a little bit to get practical around business, because first of all, there's so much to talk about in terms of the book. And the idea that, first of all, that traditional business training doesn't really embrace this new mindset that's really important. And that, I think, that initial statistic of the fact that we're trying to change in a way that isn't the same as 1985 or whatever, you know, we're not in cassette tape land, and yet that's a lot of the formal training is still based on that mindset. And I also think that this idea that something that works politically in terms of getting people to galvanize around a movement is made up of something very special that is very different and applicable in your telling of the story, very applicable to business leadership. And I'm very interested in that, as is our audience. And so I'd love to find out, first of all, there's this notion about differentiating values and shifting from that to shared values. So start with that, and then we'll walk through the idea of some companies that have done well with an example.
Sure. So this is actually an incredible thing to see when we do it in workshops, because pick an idea, any idea that people are really, really excited about. And I think agile development is a great example of this, where it has such strong differentiating values. It has an agile manifesto. It breaks away from old thinking. There's no more technical requirements. Everything's focused on user stories. And that makes people incredibly passionate about agile. So much so that usually when people come back from their first agile workshop, they're absolutely unbearable to be around for a few weeks, because they keep talking almost like fanatical about these values that they're so excited about. Those are the types of things that make people passionate about something. Those are not the things that help bring new people in. So it, you have to get people to switch from those differentiating values to the shared values. Things, so for Agile, things like high quality projects that are done on time and under budget. Because those are things that everybody shares. And then that's how you, that's the sort of common currency. And that's how you meet people where they are, not where you want them to be. And that's the first step towards bringing them in. And well, it's really an incredibly important step.
Well, I'm going to interrupt for just a second because there is kind of a paradox, right? So the individual gets infected with enthusiasm over a certain set of values or a certain set of beliefs. However, it's almost antithetical to what it will take to engage others in that same level of individual excitement. So Andrea goes to an Agile workshop, I come back, I just can't stop talking about it. But yet my peers who have no exposure to that new concept kind of scratch their heads like, well, we got to get back to business. Like, good for you, Andrea, but not necessarily going to get on my bandwagon. So I know you have examples from social movements, and also we'll talk a little bit about PNG in a second, of places where the fire, and I love the graphic on your book because it's like striking a match, right? You, if you do this well, if you lead well, you create a movement. And I live in California, so we don't like to talk about wildfires, but unfortunately it's an act of nature that, you know, if you start the right fire burning, it does have a life of its own. It spreads in a natural way. And when it's for good, it can actually have a very different impact than an individual trying to get another individual, or what you said earlier, which made no sense to me when I first thought about it. You know, why would it be different for Andrea to be inspired by factor X? And yet if a leader wants to start a movement to get everyone to feel that way, you can't just do on an individual basis what Andrea experienced, because the mainstream hasn't gotten there.
Let me cut you off there. That's not how you start a movement. That's how you grow a movement. You start a movement not by convincing people, but by identifying people who are already enthusiastic about the change. So it's actually more paradoxical than you even made it out to be, because at the one hand, you need to harness that enthusiasm. On the other hand, you need to make them open to the concerns of others outside the movement, right? You can't run a movement, right, by just preaching to the choir.
I think that's great.
That's not how you evangelize something. You evangelize it by getting out and mixing with the heretics.
Yeah, okay, so tell us a little bit about, this is not just a theory, this is an observation that you have made for many years now.
No, actually, this example is actually not in the book.
Right. In the book is like Netflix and Experian, which you.
Netflix is there. So Experian is there. Alcoa is there.
Alcoa, right.
We have plenty of it, but Procter & Gamble wasn't in there. And actually, this is kind of a funny thing, because the guys who are doing this came across Cascades and were inspired by it, or I was writing about Cascades. I forget, but basically what it was three guys, because if you go back to traditional change management, I call it the persuasion model of change, right? Yeah. Where you create a sense of sense of urgency around the change and get commitment, which made perfect sense back in 1983 when you were trying to get people to feel okay about something that already happened. But anybody who, when you're talking about changing actions, anybody who's ever been married or has a kid knows how difficult it can be to persuade even one person. If you think you're going to persuade hundreds or thousands, that's a really tough job. These guys, they didn't go and try and persuade anybody. They went and they said, let's make one change, right? There's this process in our plan, and we know it's really slow. It took like 3 weeks. It was a huge bottleneck throughout the organization. And they said, we think we can do that better. We think using digital tools, we could get it down to just a few hours. And they worked for like 6 or 8 months or something like that. And they did it. And it was a huge thing. And they won an award for it. And then they read Cascades. I'm not exactly sure what the sequence is, but they went and they said, hey, we could do that. We could use that, those principles to grow this one little project we did into a big movement, which they have. It's now called PXG. It's, I think, at 6 or 8 different facilities within Procter & Gamble's research organization. It involves, I think, a few thousand people. And it's all about going and using digital tools to improve processes at least tenfold. And it's creating an enormous wave or movement of efficiency throughout Procter & Gamble's research organization. And what I think is so great about it was these guys are true revolutionaries, right? But they didn't disrupt their organization. They made it better. They didn't ask for permission. They went and solved a problem and then they scaled it. And I thought it was like the coolest thing, especially that they said reading Cascades helped them do it. So that really felt good.
I think it's great. And I think there's a lot of takeaways here. I mean, there's one more concept that I think is important, you know, beyond this, which is this idea of skills-based transformation. And that first, the Procter & Gamble story is interesting because the idea of doing something at a small scale and figuring out ways to socialize that and bring it to a larger scale within an organization requires a talent for building these movements. And it can't just be walking around with a PowerPoint and getting people to get on board, that this process of building a cascade involves people's beliefs and really how they were able to get other people to buy in. But I'd like to also talk about another precept before we move to the final part, which is, you know, why is skills-based transformation so important? And I know you have a model and would love to have some background on what is skills-based transformation?
Well, skills-based transformation is again, something I came across after the book was written when so many people came to me with their own stories. I think a great example is Experian, which was in the book, where the CIO, a guy named Barry Libenson, he comes to the company, he spends a few months and he spends a few months talking to customers, and he finds that they're all asking for the same thing, real-time access to data. And he is a very capable CIO. He knew exactly how to solve that problem. You shift from on-premise IT architecture to a cloud-based architecture. Okay, problem solved. Except he knew that was going to be incredibly hard to do because he was going to get an enormous amount of pushback. A lot of people weren't going to like that idea. And this is, by the way, what makes transformation so hard we tend to think that transformation is making people understand how brilliant our idea is. Sure. Well, that's not the problem. Usually they understand it, they just don't want it. I mean, people talk about corporate antibodies and the corporate immune system. There's no such thing. That's a fiction. There's just a bunch of people who don't like your idea, right? Mm-hmm. And Barry knew that people weren't going to like his idea for some really good reasons. One, around cybersecurity. And a few years after he started, there was that horrible breach at their competitor, Equifax. Another, losing control of the business model. So those were really, really important objections that he would have to overcome and staunch opposition that he would have to overcome. But the cloud transformation itself was very much a strategic and technological transformation. But Barry, being a really smart guy, he also understood that transformation, that strategic and technological transformation itself wouldn't succeed without a skills-based transformation, because you couldn't make it work unless you shifted from waterfall to agile. In very much the same way, A lot of companies are finding that you can't make AI work. You can't make artificial intelligence or machine learning work without user-centric design. These are skills that have been around for 10, 20 years, but you still need to get them adopted on a massive scale within your organization. That creates a movement. And the this graphic here shows the process that I lay out in the book and that we teach in our workshops. And one thing, just to go back a little bit and to push back on something you said about it takes talent to have a movement. I guess it takes talent in terms of it takes talent to do anything. I never found that any of the movement leaders had any particular traits. In fact, even with people like Gandhi, who when he first got his law degree, he was so shy he couldn't speak up in court, and Mandela, who was this, you know, really extreme nationalist as a young man, I never found that any of these people who lead, or more my friend Serja, who overthrows countries, who started off just wanting to play bass in a rock band. What amazed me about all of these really successful transformation leaders, whether they were someone who was famous like Gandhi or Martin Luther King, or maybe not so famous like some of the other people I talk about in my book, Barry Levinson is one that I mentioned, and there's some others, is that the one talent that really seems to be important is to learn from your mistakes, that they all learned along the way. And I think one of the most important things about a movement, the idea of a movement, is that, is as the name implies, it's kinetic. It changes along the way. It's never you start off with this brilliant idea and everybody just follows behind you. You actually do have to become the change you want to see, and that means changing yourself.
I have one last question about all of this, and then we're going to do our author's dozen, which is 12 quick questions. If you were going to tell a leader today, you know, okay, Andrea, you're in charge of this team, and you've been trained that, you know, this is the end goal, and you've been trained to think of it this way, but here's this Cascades way. Do these two or three different things. What would I do Monday morning differently? You know, what's the most important, you know, maybe two things that I would do for sure to start thinking about a movement and to start thinking about building support and scaling corporate change?
Well, first I would tell you, if it's a big idea and it's going to work, if it's a big idea that works, because again, this isn't about strategy and or innovation, right? I'm a big fan of strategy and innovation. I've wrote a whole book about that stuff. This is not that. This is about getting adopted, getting an idea scaled. So the first thing I would tell you is to understand that the reason why transformations fails is because somebody hates it and is working to undermine it. So the first thing I would say is, imagine an completely evil person and think about it, how an evil person would work to undermine you in a completely dishonest way. And what would they do? Because there's a good chance that's going to happen. And then I would say, think about where you're vulnerable, where they're going to attack, how they're going to attack you, and where they're going to attack you. And then thirdly, I would say, think about how an appeal to shared values, right? It's not about the Agile Manifesto. It's about better projects, right? Think about how that appeal to shared values would mitigate those attacks. But anticipate, always anticipating, because if you think that nobody's going to oppose your idea, you're not thinking hard enough.
I think it's practical. I think it's different. I think it's refreshing. What I like about Cascades is that there's a combination of business wisdom and also a lot of counterintuitive concepts that make a ton of sense after the fact.
May I tell just one last story?
Absolutely.
Because it's one of my favorite, and I think one of the most instructive stories in the book. My friend Sirjah, he started off as a revolutionary in 1992 with a bunch of anti-war protests. He calls it their Occupy phase. So a bunch of students protested the war in Bosnia and at all the major universities in Belgrade. They played a lot of music, they drank some beer, and then classes were over, summer came, and all the protests broke up, and that was the end of that. Then that was in 1992. In 1996, they had a bit more success. They were part of a big movement that won local elections. And then Milosevic said he wasn't going to recognize them. There were massive protests. And eventually he did recognize them, but then the unity fell apart and everything went back to the way it was. So again, 1996, another failure. 1998, they could tell that Milosevic wanted to go to war again. They said, look, we have to do something. Five guys got together. And then another six joined them. But five guys got together, well, four guys and one girl, got together in a coffee shop and said, we have to do something. And they thought, what can we do? And they said, well, if we can mobilize people to get to the polls, we can win the election. And they know that they could do that because they had seen it in 1996. He said, and if we can win the election, Milosevic is going to steal it. And when he steals it, that's our chance. They were planning not to win the election, but they were anticipating that he was going to steal it. And 1999, a year later, Otpor, which was the organization, maybe had 300 people. Any reasonable person would look at Serbia and say, you know, Slobodan Milosevic, he's going to rule the rest of his life. A year after that, Milosevic lost the election. There was a massive movement, took him from power. A year after that or so, he was in The Hague. A few years after that, he dies in his prison cell. That's how change happens. Slowly at first, and then very, very quickly.
It's one of our favorite concepts. So this brings us to the author's dozen, and it goes really fast. And you can just say anything is fair game. So right now, what's overhyped?
Digital technology.
And what's underhyped?
What's underhyped is materials and manufacturing, the physical world technologies.
What's your favorite quote, real or imagined?
G.H. Hardy, for any serious purpose, intelligence is a rather minor gift.
Well, what's your favorite statistic, real or imagined?
Carson Wentz threw for over 4,000 yards with no receivers getting over 500 yards last year.
That true?
Yeah, yeah.
That's amazing. Okay.
As a Philly girl, you should be keeping up with
this. As a Philly girl. Not a sports girl necessarily. I'm trying. So other than Sean Moffitt and Andrea Cates, the future proofers, who would you invite over to a Changemakers Last Supper? Like, what's the one person you would invite for sure to a Changemakers Last Supper?
I would say Richard Feynman, just for the laughs.
Yeah, we know that some of these last suppers don't turn out so well, but that's a whole other story. If you were 23 again, not that you're not 23, but if you were 23 again, given what you know now, what would you be doing?
You know what, I would join the Peace Corps because I spent a significant time, 15 years overseas, and anybody who joined the Peace Corps seemed to really have a great experience, and it really seemed to benefit them professionally later on. So, and they learn language skills and cultural skills, and I think it's one of the most underrated programs. I wish I had known somebody who'd done the Peace Corps when I was as that age, because when I was older, and having met so many people who did it and benefited from it, I really wish I'd done something like that.
Okay, so here's a doubleheader. A company you admire today that we've heard of, and a company you admire today that we've maybe never heard of.
I think there's a lot of companies I admire today. Usually I admire companies like Procter & Gamble and IBM, companies that are still competitive after 100 years. I think those are ones that we can really, really learn from. I'm really impressed with Google and how they have built, how they have invested in the technologies, in the next thing after search, even though they don't know what that thing is, but how much they're doing with self-driving cars and quantum computing and all sorts of stuff to so that the company will survive when search isn't such a great business anymore. Company you've never heard of that I think is just amazing. It's a company called Citrine Informatics. They're in the materials discovery space. And they sort of remind me of a little bit of Google, but more of like Genentech, like a company that is almost single-handedly inventing its own category.
How do you spell it?
Citrine, Citrine. The CEO is a guy named Greg Maholand.
He could be on a future podcast. And how would you like other people to describe you? This is not an epitaph question, but how would you like other people to describe you as a change maker or impact maker? Like what would be like three words?
Empowers others. I would like to be thought of as somebody who's helpful and empowers others.
What's a technology or emerging innovation that is intriguing for you?
Certainly quantum computing, but computer architectures in general, but also I think what's going on in material science is amazing, as well as synthetic biology. But I think those three things are really what's going to drive the next 30, 40, 50 years.
And last one, before we do the closeout, is what do you do for fun?
My 10-year-old daughter is the most fun. And I, when I'm doing something fun, I'm usually doing it with her and my wife. And this coronavirus crisis, as tough as it's been, getting the time to go on walks and spend more time with them has been an absolute prize.
Well, this has been fascinating. We always run out of time before we run out of topics. And I wanted to thank Greg Sattell. You've been really interesting and it's a good conversation. A lot to think about in terms of the way that leaders, especially in business, which is our audience, can rethink assumptions and start to build movements in this new way of thinking. And we hope everybody buys the book. It didn't come out when did it come out?
It came out August 12th,
2019. So 2019, and it's at least as relevant.
Excuse
as
me, April 12th. A year ago this week.
Congratulations. That. Happy birthday to them. Yeah. And once again, we are future-proofing next, and we are a practical path to a bolder future. We'd like to thank Greg Sattell for helping to lead us to some new ways of thinking about leadership and business in the practical path to a bolder future. Thanks, Greg.
Thanks for having me, Andrea.